From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherie Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, rogue states and nuclear outlaws, we talk with defense analyst Michael Clare about America's defense strategy in the post-Cold War world. Also today, one family's legacy of abandonment. We talk with Jan Waldron about her new memoir, Giving Away Simone. Waldron got pregnant at 17, gave up her baby for adoption, and became the fifth generation of mothers in her family to leave or give up a child. We'll also speak with the daughter Waldron gave up for adoption. They've since become very close. TV critic David Bianculli reviews a comedy salute to Andy Kaufman coming up on NBC. And Maureen Corrigan reviews a new novel by Jane Smiley. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The Federal Reserve has decided to leave interest rates alone. The central bank's Federal Open Market Committee had been expected to hold the line on rates at this meeting, since seven previous rate increases seem to have kept the lid on inflation. The discount rate remains at 5.25%. That is the rate the Fed charges member banks for loans. The federal funds rate, which banks charge each other for short-term loans, remains at 6%. Analysts say the Federal Reserve is trying to create a soft landing for the U.S. economy. This will allow it to keep expanding, but at a less vigorous rate that will not spark inflation. A massive landslide has closed traffic on one section of the Pacific Coast Highway north of Los Angeles. The bluff above the highway was soaked by rain, and it gave way yesterday. Officials are still cleaning up the mess. NPR's Mandalit Del Barco reports.
The landslide dumped an estimated 90,000 tons of mud, rocks, trees, and other debris onto the Pacific Coast Highway, burying the busy thoroughfare up to 30 feet deep in muck. It had been a warm, sunny day when witnesses say they saw several large eucalyptus trees come crashing down, along with an entire hillside that they say sounded like an immense roar or earthquake. Civil engineers say the slide was the result of unusually heavy rains over the last month that weakened the bluff overlooking the highway. A disaster preparedness team is searching for anyone possibly buried below, though so far they haven't found any victims. Officials hope to reopen the Pacific Coast Highway within a day, and drivers are taking alternate routes in and out of the area. I'm Mandalit Del Barco in Los Angeles.
Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi says that his country will defy an air travel embargo that has been called by the United Nations. It takes effect next month. NPR's Suni Khalid reports.
Libya's Muammar Gaddafi said that he was sending passenger flights to Saudi Arabia next month, despite a United Nations ban on air travel. The flights are intended to take Libyans to the annual Hajj religious pilgrimage, which begins in May. Gaddafi warned that if the flights were banned or shot down en route to Saudi Arabia, this would mean that the Kaaba, or the Prophet's tomb in Mecca, and Saudi Arabia were under American domination. He urged the Saudis to let the Libyan planes land. Last Hajj season, Gaddafi sent Libyan pilgrims overland by camel caravan before they caught flights to Saudi Arabia from third countries. Libya has been suffering under increased political and economic isolation, stemming from its alleged role in the downing of Pan Am Flight 103 over Lockerbie, Scotland, in 1988. I'm Suni Khalid in Cairo.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has fallen almost 3 points to 4,154. Trading is heavy. The Nasdaq is up almost 2 at 824. This is NPR. Two of Japan's elite banks have announced an agreement in principle to merge. The Mitsubishi Bank and the Bank of Tokyo will join and create the world's biggest bank. NPR's Julie McCarthy reports from Tokyo.
With combined assets of more than $800 billion, the merger will produce not only the largest bank in the world, but also one of the most powerful new forces in international banking. The Bank of Tokyo specializes in international business, while Mitsubishi Bank concentrates on domestic banking. It's a marriage, say analysts, that is as practical as it is powerful because it unites international and domestic banking business. Japan's bank suffered tremendous losses in the bursting of its bubble economy in the late 1980s, and today Today's merger announcement is likely, according to experts, to widen the gap between weak and strong banks. Over the long run, analysts say the merging of such banking giants will lead to economies of scale that should reduce costs for consumers. In Tokyo, this is Julie McCarthy.
A children's advocate says the welfare overhaul bill passed by the House of Representatives would create a social disaster. The president of the Children's Defense Fund, Marion Wright Edelman, says the bill destroys federal protection for needy and disabled children. She says it does nothing to help poor families get jobs. She also says it will also rather merge dozens of social programs into block grants to the states. Republicans argue their plan will make welfare more efficient and less costly for taxpayers. Philadelphia commuters have had some trouble getting around today. City transit workers are on strike. Union employees walked out at midnight after talks broke down with the Philadelphia Transit Authority. The strike shuts down the city's buses, trolleys, and subways. Some 350,000 commuters have been affected. Suburban trains and rapid transit lines aren't affected yet, but some of them are close to a strike deadline, too. The Transit Authority has added some cars to its trains. The city is supposed to open extra parking spaces. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When the Cold War ended, America had to rethink its defense and military priorities. My guest Michael Clare says we may be heading in the wrong direction. We're designing a military that is geared to fight another Gulf War, another war with a so-called rogue state. But Clare says we're not preparing for the other more common peril that faces us, the global chaos caused by ethnic wars, religious conflicts, and nationalist struggles. In other words, he says, while we prepare to fight another war with a rogue state like Iraq, we have no strategy for dealing with Bosnia, Rwanda, or Haiti. Clare is a professor of peace and world security studies at Hampshire College. He's the author of the new book, Rogue States and Nuclear Outlaws, America's Search for a New Foreign Policy. The book critiques the wisdom of building our defense strategy around the rogue state.
The rogue state is a manufactured concept. It describes a group of rising third world powers that are considered hostile by U.S. leaders, countries like Libya and Iran and Iraq and North Korea that have a history of hostility to the United States. Also, countries that are pursuing weapons of mass destruction, chemical or nuclear weapons, in violation of international norms. It's a combination of hostility and the pursuit of weapons of mass destruction that's been described by this term rogue states.
What do you think of this as being a manufactured threat? It seems like these states pose real threats.
They certainly do pose threats, but in the panoply of possible threats or of proliferators, they're not at the top of the list. Countries like India and Pakistan and Israel, Argentina and Brazil have moved much further in the proliferation direction than the countries that I've named that are really Johnny-come-latelys. So we do want to do everything we can to stop them in their tracks, and I think that's entirely possible. But the problem of proliferation really requires that we look at countries that have gone much further in this direction, like India and Pakistan, and find ways to persuade them to dismantle their very elaborate nuclear infrastructure.
You're actually very cynical about how the rogue state came to be such a centerpiece of our foreign policy.
I think that it's understandable that the Department of Defense, with the crisis they faced after the fall of the Berlin Wall of not having an identifiable enemy anymore, that they sought enemies around which to organize their thinking, their budget plans, their strategy plans. It's a very natural thing that they've done. And I understand how they came to this process of choosing these states as our next enemy. The problem to me is that this was never debated by the American people or Congress. And we've never had a chance to argue whether we want to build our defense policy about the prospects of endless wars with this group of third world countries.
Maybe you could describe for us how our defense policy is defined by the rogue states.
Under our current military policy, which is called the bottom-up review, this was done by Secretary of Defense Les Aspin in 1993 before he was replaced by the current Secretary of Defense. The bottom-up review says that the United States shall be prepared indefinitely into the future to fight two Desert Storm-like wars against Iraq-like emerging third world powers. It's called a two-war strategy or the two major regional conflict scenario. So we're going to have enough army divisions and aircraft carriers and tactical fighter planes to fight two desert storms simultaneously. And when you work out the math, that comes out to be a force only slightly smaller than the one that we devised for fighting the Soviet Union throughout the Cold War period.
So in your mind, is the rogue state scenario a rationale for keeping up defense forces?
In my view, it's a rationale for keeping up certain kinds of defense forces, forces which are intended to fight large modern militaries equipped with modern weapons. In other words, countries that look like the former Warsaw Pact. And certainly North Korea fits that to some degree. The question is, are those the kinds of threats that our military is going to face? As I've suggested, that's among the least likely scenarios we're going to face, is two desert storms simultaneously. We're much more likely to see a rash of Rwanda's, Haiti's, Bosnia's occurring simultaneously. And I think for that, we need a very different kind of force.
Well, I want to get to that idea in a second, but it does seem like there are enough third world countries with dictators who are either mentally unstable or utterly unpredictable, who, even though it's not in their national interest to do so, would challenge the United States, like Saddam Hussein.
Well, Saddam Hussein, at the time that he started the invasion of Kuwait, had a number of very peculiar circumstances that I don't think are repeatable. First of all, he had a million-man army with the best weaponry that a third-world leader has ever accumulated, and there's nobody else like that now. He was also under the impression that he had a friend in the White House, George Bush, who practically up to the last minute before the invasion of Kuwait was reassuring Saddam Hussein of America's friendship. And I think that Hussein didn't appreciate how things had changed in Washington and how his behavior would prompt a very strong reaction. Had he known that, I don't think he would have gone ahead. But he acted under a very cold calculation that told him he had a good chance of success.
Think of how close we came to fighting with North Korea.
Yes, I'm very worried about it. And there's a case where I think the leadership on both sides, in the North and the South, understands that a war between the two would be an absolute catastrophe no matter who won. There's likely to be a million dead people, including many American soldiers, and terrible destruction on both sides. And I think there is an understanding there that war should be avoided at all costs. And yet we did see a period last spring about this time when the U.S. and North Korea were moving in the direction of war. And I think it's only when Jimmy Carter went to North Korea and talked with North Korean leaders that they were able to turn that momentum around.
But doesn't that make you think that maybe we are pretty close to fighting with rogue states?
I do worry very much that this kind of demonology of calling these states rogues and seeing them as implacable foes will create a self-fulfilling prophecy in which we'll jump into a war with them that might otherwise have been avoided. I do worry about that.
Well, how does calling a state like North Korea or Iraq a rogue state lead to the possibility of a self-fulfilling prophecy of war?
Well, first of all, our military is training all of the time to go to war with these countries. These are the designated enemies. And so when an incident occurs, like these two American citizens who have been captured by the Iraqis and sentenced to jail, or the Iranians setting up bases in the Persian Gulf, our tendency is to view this as a very serious crisis and to think about military options. If we were dealing with an ally, a country that or a country we felt friendly about, we would be sending ambassadors over, perhaps, having high-level meetings, but not threatening military action, which is the case with the rogues.
But what would you call Iraq under Saddam Hussein or North Korea as it defies all kind of international nuclear standards? What would you call them other than rogue states?
I would call them rising third world powers, like others that we have very friendly relations with, like India and Israel and Argentina and Brazil, that engaged in even more egregious violations of nonproliferation agreements.
Well, what's the logical next step after that, that we should be treating North Korea like Israel or Israel like North Korea?
Well, I think that nuclear nonproliferation has to be enforced equally and unilaterally to all countries. Otherwise, it's going to give the impression that it's okay for some countries to pursue nuclear weapons and not others. And I don't think that's the message we want to communicate. I think the message we want to communicate is that no country should be pursuing nuclear or chemical weapons and will face sanctions if they do.
Michael Clear is my guest. He's a professor of peace and world security studies at Hampshire College and author of the new book, Rogue States and Nuclear Outlaws, America's Search for a New Foreign Policy. You are arguing that we should be gearing our defense policy toward dealing with what has happened, for instance, in Bosnia and Somalia and Haiti, regional conflicts, ethnic conflicts, and instead we're gearing our foreign policy around rogue states like North Korea and Iraq. What's the difference between how we would equip our military to deal with the regional conflicts that you think we should be worrying about and the rogue state scenario that is more central to our current defense policy?
The current policy, the bottom-up review, which assumes we're going to be fighting an infinite series of desert storm-like operations, calls for a very high-tech, capital-intensive, heavy-unit kind of army. Lots of tanks, lots of supersonic jet planes with advanced munitions, big ships, aircraft carriers. When we're looking at ethnic and sectarian conflicts and peacekeeping and humanitarian rescue, you want light forces, lightly equipped forces that could be moved quickly to different parts of the world, operate in an austere landscape where there are very few facilities, but bring in what's needed in the way of medical care and communications, and that's able to get in and out very rapidly and doesn't have a lot of heavy equipment.
Do you think we basically need two different sets of forces, one to fight and one as peacekeepers, each to be trained completely differently?
Well, what I think we need for a national security posture is an ability to do many different things. It is possible that we'll have to fight again on a large scale as in Desert Storm. I'm not ruling that out, and we need some capacity to be able to do that. What I'm arguing about now is we've put all our eggs in this one basket of major regional conflicts and not left any capability or resources for all the other imaginable problems that we're going to have. So what we need is a lot of flexibility and an ability to do different sorts of things as needed, as the world situation demands.
I know you admire Jimmy Carter's efforts to mediate international disputes. What's he doing right?
What Jimmy is doing right, and it sometimes rankles us too, I might say, is saying at the beginning that all sides have a legitimate point of view in this and that we have to hear all sides, that there isn't a good guys and a bad guys, or one side is beyond the pale, beyond talking to. And I think when he went to talk with the Bosnian Serbs, I felt very uncomfortable, and many people do, that these people have done terrible things. And yet, if you're going to resolve conflict without violence, you have to go to the other side. You have to hear their point of view. You have to hear their grievances and resentments, as well as the side you might feel more comfortable with. And that's what he's doing right.
Michael Clear, the first time you joined us on Fresh Air several years ago, I think the subject was low-intensity conflict, acronym being LIC, L-I-C. And this is a subject you'd been writing about for years, how small, regional, low-intensity conflicts were becoming the most common wars and how these were going to be the wars of the future as well. I don't hear that expression very much anymore, although it still seems we're very concerned with outbreaks of small conflicts around the world. So where are we now in terms of what had been called low-intensity conflict? And how does your point of view now compare to the point of view you had a few years ago when you were writing about low-intensity conflict?
Well, I think the big difference, Terry, is when that term was developed in the 1980s, LIC, low-intensity conflict, the assumption was that this was a manifestation of the Cold War, that either we were supporting a group that was fighting the Soviet Union and its allies, like we were supporting the Contras, or we were supporting a government against a communist-supported insurgency. So that in each case, there were good guys and bad guys, and we were going to be on the side that we thought of as the good guys. So we were either aiding insurgency, pro-insurgency, the Reagan Doctrine, or we were in counterinsurgency, fighting against an insurgency. We still see many ethnic and sectarian conflicts, but now we don't see them as manifestations of the Cold War, where there are good guys and bad guys. More often than not, we don't take sides, and we shouldn't take sides in these conflicts. Our interests are in peace and in reconciliation of the parties. And I think that's a very different sort of environment and a very different sort of challenge. We're not going in to win a conflict. We're going in to prevent it or resolve it or ameliorate the killing. It's a different sort of responsibility.
Michael Clare, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
It's been my pleasure, Terry.
Michael Clare is the author of the book Rogue States and Nuclear Outlaws. He's defense correspondent for The Nation and a professor at Hampshire College. We have a review of a new TV special after a break. This is Fresh Air. Tomorrow night, NBC presents a one-hour special called A Comedy Salute to Andy Kaufman. TV critic David Bianculli has a review.
The first TV review I ever wrote was for Florida's Gainesville Sun 20 years ago. I was just finishing college and convinced the local paper to let me write a review of a brand new show that seemed to be aimed at people my age. That show was the premiere of Saturday Night Live, and one of the performers that night was Andy Kaufman, whose whole act was to stand next to an old record player and lip-sync to the Mighty Mouse theme. Not the whole song, just the one line that Mighty Mouse sings. He was so weird and so unlike any other stand-up comic that the crowd loved him. So did I. Andy Kaufman's career basically covered a 10-year span from that first Saturday Night Live appearance in 1975 until his death from cancer in 1984. In between, he gave us Foreign Man, the squeaky-voiced character that evolved into Latka on Taxi, and Tony Clifton, the rude nightclub singer, and Andy, the intergender wrestling champion, an Elvis impersonator, an all-around comic performance artist. This NBC special covers all those bases and adds quick comments from a lot of friends and colleagues. Some of these interviews are interesting. Michael Richards, now of Seinfeld, tells the real story behind Kaufman's unexpected blow-up on the ABC late-night show Fridays. And Jim Carrey reveals a surprising secret about Andy's alter ego of Tony Clifton. But a lot of Andy's performances depended on context and on length of time, two things that can't really be recreated in a fast-moving one-hour special. For example, we see a few seconds of Andy on Saturday Night Live reading from The Great Gatsby. But what really made that so funny then was that Saturday Night Live was live, and that Andy just kept reading and reading and reading and reading and reading and reading. See how quickly that can cross the line from amusing to irritating? That was the line where Andy Kaufman lived. And when he went on other TV shows, from David Letterman to The Dating Game, no one quite knew what to expect. That's the attitude that most impressed Andy's fellow comics, including, of all people, Bob Saget, one of this special's unlikely hosts.
While living in the comedy clubs for like 10 years, probably no other performer had as big an influence on me as Andy Kaufman. Of course, there's no evidence of that in my television work, but I really, really did admire Andy, especially his work on late night television, where he eventually got an audience with the king of comedy, Johnny Carson.
Good. Where are you from originally?
From Caspiar. It's Ireland.
Caspiar?
Caspiar.
That's a first in show business.
And although this special is packaged way too conventionally, it does have one truly priceless moment not to be missed. It's a clip from the time when Andy, as a largely unknown comic, convinced the producers of The Dating Game to let him be a contestant as Foreign Man.
Fashion number one. Number one, would you say hi to Patrice, please?
How you doing, Patrice?
How about number two?
How you doing today, Patrice?
And number three?
Hello, Patrice.
Bachelor number three, it's the holiday season, and I'm Santa. You're on my lap. Little boy, take it away.
What? Wait a minute. Wait. I don't know what she look like. Could I see what she look like?
No, you can't. You can't, number three. No.
But I don't know who she is.
No, I know. But
I'm Santa.
She's beautiful.
And
Santa Claus?
Little... Right.
But you don't sound like Santa Claus.
You also didn't choose Bachelor number three. Baji,
no.
Kimran, Baji,
but
come on and say hello,
no.
Please.
I won. I answered all the questions right.
That young bachelorette didn't know what she was missing.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. He reviewed a comedy salute to Andy Kaufman, airing Wednesday on NBC. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional funding is provided by Living Language. Learn a new language at home or on the go with Living Language. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, one family's legacy of abandonment. When Jan Waldron was 17, she became pregnant and gave up the baby for adoption. She says she turned away from her child just like her great-great-grandmother, great-grandmother, grandmother, and mother had done. But 11 years after giving her daughter up for adoption, Waldron reconnected with her daughter. They've since become very close. Jan Waldron has written a memoir called Giving Away Simone. We'll meet Waldron and the daughter she gave away. And Maureen Corrigan reviews the new novel, Moo, by Pulitzer Prize-winning writer James Smiley. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The Senate has approved a resolution condemning Iraq for imprisoning two Americans. The U.S. government says they accidentally strayed into Iraqi territory and Iraqi authorities jailed them. Iowa Senator Tom Harkin took the resolution to the Senate floor.
I rise to speak out and defend the human rights of two Americans unjustly sentenced to 8 years in prison for what essentially amounts to an honest mistake of not knowing where they were. Imprisonment in this case is unconscionable. Both Mr. Daliberti and Mr. Barloon, on the basis of their fundamental human rights and humanitarian considerations, should be immediately and unconditionally released.
Meanwhile, the United States has not ruled out any action, including military, that might be needed to secure the Americans' freedom, UBI's Pi Chamberlain reports.
Pentagon spokesman Kenneth Bacon says the detention of the two Americans is outrageous. He says diplomatic efforts are being pursued to get them released. He says the United States is asking for help not only from the Polish diplomats who have been helping America on the matter, but also from Russian, French, and Turkish diplomats. He was asked about military options.
First, I think it's irresponsible now to talk about military options at a time when we're pursuing a number of diplomatic options. Secondly, we have not ruled out anything.
He says he is not aware that the Pentagon has been asked to look into military options. Pi Chamberlain, Washington.
The White House says it will ask the United Nations to impose an oil embargo against Libya because of its refusal to turn over two suspects in the bombing of Pan Am Flight 103. Spokesman Mike McCurry says the United States has already started consultations with members of the Security Council. Libya has refused to surrender the two men to stand trial. 270 people died when the Pan Am flight was destroyed over Scotland in December 1988. Philadelphia commuters have had some trouble getting around today. City transit workers are on strike. Union employees walked out at midnight after talks broke down with the Philadelphia Transit Authority. The strike shuts down the city's buses, trolleys, and subways. Some 350,000 daily passengers have been affected. Suburban trains and rapid transit lines aren't affected yet. However, some of them are close to a strike deadline, too. The Transit Authority has added some cars to its trains, and the city is supposed to open some 8,000 emergency parking places. All six lanes of the Pacific Coast Highway north of Los Angeles are closed to commuter traffic today. One lane is open for emergency vehicles. A landslide has dumped some 90,000 tons of mud on the road. Earth-moving equipment and dump trucks are trying to clear away the mess. A civil engineer says the slide was triggered by unusually heavy rain, which weakened the coastal bluff. On Wall Street today, in unofficial figures, the Dow lost 5.5 points. This is NPR. The United Nations has opened its climate change conference in Berlin. The 11-day conference will look at ways to avert global warming. The BBC's Carolyn Wyatt reports.
Delegates from some 130 countries battle their way through gusts of unseasonal snow and hail to make the opening session of this UN conference on climate change. The environment minister of the host country Germany, Angela Merkel, elected president of these proceedings, opened the conference with a plea for urgent action by all countries to protect the earth from the threat of global warming. She said that radical changes in production and consumption would have to be made if what she called the grave and irreversible consequences of climate change were to be avoided. However, it's already clear that the chances of a binding agreement being adopted here are slim, although the German Environment Minister said progress would be made.
Carolyn Wyatt reporting. Long-distance phone companies could get a break on what they pay to connect with local phone lines. Regulators say the savings might be passed to consumers. The Federal Communications Commission says nearly half of today's long-distance revenue goes to local phone companies. Those firms supply systems to make and receive long-distance calls that come in from elsewhere. Consumer activists are worried that any extra savings may never make it to customers. The FCC will examine the issue on Thursday. Analysts suggest the Federal Reserve won't raise interest rates again in the future. The bank's top policymakers have met today and decided not to raise interest rates for the time being. Some believe interest rates will rise, however, in the future, two or even three more times before the year is over. But several say the next rate increase won't come until much later this year. On Wall Street, the stock market closed mixed today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost more than 5 points to end the day at 4,151.81. Advances and declines closed almost even in heavy trading of 320 million shares. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Adoption has become the subject of romanticizing and reactionary rhetoric, according to my guest, Jen Waldron. She says she wants to give an honest and emotionally complex picture of adoption. Waldron's great-great-grandmother, great-grandmother, grandmother, and mother had all abandoned their children or given them up for adoption. At the age of 17, Jan Waldron continued that legacy. She had a child out of wedlock and gave her away to a couple she knew. Waldron went to college, got married, had two sons, and was delighted to be a mother capable of keeping her children. 11 years after Waldron gave up her daughter, they made contact and in the intervening years have become very close. Jan Waldron and her daughter Rebecca Farrell are my guests. Jan Waldron writes about their relationship in her new memoir, Giving Away Simone. Waldron told me the story of how she reconnected with the daughter she gave away. Waldron's brother had maintained contact with the adoptive parents.
One day, a friend of my brother's told me that this girl, Rebecca, had asked her about her mother, about her birth mother, that she always knew that my brother was her birth uncle. And so she saw my brother as a link to me. And this friend who was with my brother, Rebecca just poured a chain of questions into her ear and wanted to know, what is my mother like? What does she look like? Who are my brothers? What are they like? And this friend reported back to me this. And I thought, well, I felt brave enough and strong enough. And I also felt that it may be time to bring my daughter to my sons. I always wanted her to be a natural part of their lives. I didn't want her to arrive later in their lives as this kind of familial aberration. I wanted them to have a natural course with each other.
And how old were your sons then?
They were 1 and 2.
Let me introduce your birth daughter, Rebecca, into the conversation. Rebecca, welcome.
Thank you.
Why did you want to find out what your birth mother was like, and why did you want to meet her?
Why did I want to find out what she was like?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I wanted to find out who she was because it made sense to me.
Did you know anything about her?
Yes, I did.
From the brother?
No. Oh, no. We never talked about that. In fact, the only time I ever approached him was when he had brought his friend, who was a little bit more easy to approach about these sorts of issues. No, my adoptive parents were very, very open and supportive, and they had said to me, you know, as far back as I can remember, that I would have access to her at some point in the future. And it was sort of this kind of, you know, serendipitous thing. It was just out there. It would happen at one point. And so I thought about it, you know, on a regular day-to-day basis when I was growing up.
Rebecca, how much of a mother did you want Jan to be? And what did you see her role as being compared to your adoptive mother's role?
At the time? At the time, I wanted her to be as much of a mother as I felt she was inherent in having given birth to me. You know, I felt that I wanted her to take that on, to take responsibility and be a mother in the same capacity that my mom was a mother to me, which I later discovered was not at all the way that it could or should or would work out. But at the time, I wanted to call her mom. I wanted to introduce her to my friends as my mom. I wanted her to you know, provide certain rules for me. So I definitely in the real beginning wanted her to mother me.
And Jen, how did you feel about that?
I did not feel comfortable with that. I was ever conscious of the fact that she had a mom, and I would never be her mom. I was mom to my sons. I felt very aware and protective of Rebecca's adoptive mother. It was a sacred relationship that her mother had with her from birth, and Rebecca took that as more rejection of her. So it got very complicated.
Well, Jan, did you speak with Rebecca's adoptive mother about the nature of your relationship?
No, and I wished, that's a regret of mine. I wish that we had communicated for whatever reason. I think we just trusted that we would continue to have the faith in each other that we had had from the beginning, which is bound by the fact that I gave them my child and they accepted my child. And we figured we would continue on that course of faith and hope and trust. But I do feel, had I to do this over again, I would almost insist that we communicate. That I would just ask questions like, what does she feel? What is she like? What are her allergies? Does she like spaghetti? Does she sleep at night? You know, how has she done? What was her life like the first 11 years? You know, those kind of questions. And so that's a part of this experience that I regret not having.
My guest is Jan Waldron, author of the memoir Giving Away Simone. Also with us is the daughter Waldron gave up for adoption, Rebecca Farrell. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Jan Waldron and the daughter she gave up for adoption, Rebecca Farrell. Rebecca, I'd like you to read a letter that you wrote to Jan in 1989. How old would that have made you?
89, 18, 19, 19, okay. I guess.
And this is when you thought that the relationship was at a crossroads. And you wanted a different kind of love, a more maternal love than mm-hmm. you felt Jan was really providing you.
Mm-hmm.
Would you read the excerpt of the letter for us?
Jan, nobody told you that babies were supposed to cry when they're hungry, when they need their diapers changed, or when they need to be held? How much thought did you put into it? Really? I realize that the majority ruled against keeping me and that you were young and scared, but I find it hard to believe that with your girl's Latin school intelligence, you didn't know that babies cried. You said to me once, or maybe twice, that you would listen to whatever I had to say as long as there was no meanness. Well, I'm sorry. I feel mean. I have parents and I love them very much. You carried me for 9 months. You felt my first breath. Without you, I would not be here. I love you more than anyone or anything in this world for that. I loved you that much before I met you. It wasn't until I met you that the resentment set in, seeing your graceful and strong arms that didn't hold me for so much longer.
You know, I guess, Rebecca, when I was reading this letter, I was really trying to understand why you held it against your mother in such a personal way that she gave you away, that you couldn't understand at all the predicament she was in as a 17-year-old, not really understanding
thing to do was. Inherent in your saying understand means that it's a cerebral action, you know, that you think about it. The feelings that I have about her giving me up are really instinctive and visceral. You know, it's a kind of gut-wrenching pain. You know, I can understand and intellectualize it as much as I want to, but the pain is still there.
Jan, there's a letter I'd like you to read that you wrote to Rebecca.
Okay. Rebecca.
And tell us when this is dated.
This is August 25th, 1989. Rebecca, you have systematically trashed whatever vulnerabilities I've expressed to you. What I have shared in trust has come back at me, in my face, whether it was when I expressed sadness or when I told you about my feelings at 17. And of course you damned me for not loving you deeply enough or unconditionally, like other people in your life. I have realized how bullied I've allowed myself to be by you. I have been trying to leap through flaming hoops to validate my love when none of this should have been asked of me, much less attempted by me. We have found ourselves on a treadmill, replaying tired themes, so it is freeing for me to know that this part of our relationship is over. I do not agree that I can help you anymore. The work left to be done is your work. I think I would get in the way. I feel you must face much of your confusion on your own or with the help of an objective third party. The source of the problem, me, cannot assist in the resolution of it. Doesn't mean I'm not available for talk, letters, whatever. But my efforts have been unproductive and redundant. You are always welcome here. You know that. Love, Jan.
I guess what interested me most in that letter is when you were talking about everything you were trying to do to validate your love, and you say, when none of this should have been asked of me, much less attempted by me. What were you thinking then about the nature of your relationship and whether you'd gone too far in trying to become too close and trying to be the mother of a daughter who had adoptive parents?
I think when I wrote that, I wasn't thinking that necessarily, but simply that my love for her at that point should speak for itself and that her love for me should do the same. And wasn't that enough? And that it seemed like the more I gave, the more I was asked to give. And I always did feel that, I always just felt very aware of her parents and often felt, you know, she has two mothers when I have none and how lucky she is. But she didn't feel lucky.
I guess, you know, I was thinking when I was reading this book that during the teenage years, so many mothers and daughters have their flare-ups, mm-hmm. birth mothers and their daughters. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
That love in the parent-child relationship doesn't mean automatically accepting each other's actions as being wonderful. I mean, there's so much criticism in the parent-child relationship, particularly during the teenage years, when the teenager's really down on the mother. Mm-hmm. The mother's trying to kind of discipline the teenager and bring him up on the straight and narrow and everything.
There's no question. And had I known, I mean, that it's part, you know, I write about that, that to inherit an 11-year-old girl is one thing. To inherit one that you haven't brought up is quite another. And then to face the reasons why it is that you haven't brought her up. But 11-year-old girls are on the cusp of being really repulsive. You know, they're difficult and for all the hormonal, social reasons. And so there she was. So it was all of that combined with our circumstance and our history or lack thereof.
Rebecca, was there a turning point for you where you came to accept that your birth mother gave you away for better or worse, that she kind of suffered over that decision for all the years afterwards, and that you should move on and take it from there?
Yeah, there was a turning point after one of our impasse lapses of getting along. You know, every couple of years we'd have these big fallouts. One summer I stayed in my uncle's house, and he and I sat down and talked, and it had been really the first time that I'd heard the story from him, someone who had so much love and protectiveness towards Jan. You know, he really told the story of my adoption and my circumstances in a very sort of sensitive and core way. And I all of a sudden thought, you know, wow, you know, this is really an incredible thing that she went through, and it really was very difficult, and I can't begin to feel what it must have felt like to be in her shoes, but I can certainly start thinking about it, you know, certainly start integrating that memory into the way that we deal with each other.
How old were you?
I was 20. 20, yeah.
So you were, at that time, 3 years older than she was when she had you.
Right, mm-hmm.
What's your relationship like now?
Good. Comparatively blissful.
It is. It's really good. Rebecca and I, and I think we've come to this point where we do accept that everybody, every family has issues, right? I mean, there are a few that do not. In fact, I believe there probably are none. But we do we have a chronic family issue, and that family issue is that I gave her away. And that doesn't mean that we don't have peace or relief from that or joy, which we certainly do. We have all of those things. But it's a problem that's never going to go away, and there's no reachable resolution. So we live with this.
But we're still family.
But we are family, and it's a family issue.
Jen, when you gave your daughter up for adoption, you knew the adoptive parents.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that knowledge, you and your birth daughter were united
mm-hmm.
years later.
Right.
What do you think now of the idea of open adoption? A lot of people, for better or worse, would never have the kind of emotionally complicated story that you and Rebecca have now.
Mm-hmm.
And I think some people might almost feel glad that they are protected from the complexities of the relationship and the ambiguities of the relationship.
Fine.
And the demands of the relationship.
Okay, but that's life. You know, that is part of life. That is, loss is part of life. It's part of the facts. By keeping it closed and buried and quiet and unspoken does not change the facts.
And it's part of the adoptive process, really. I mean, you really can't adopt a child, somebody else's child, without allowing them the option to know who made them. I mean, it just doesn't seem right. It doesn't make sense to me. It doesn't seem natural at all. And it seems so dishonest to think that you could take this child from somebody else and raise it as if it never had any history or came from anywhere except from the sky, which is a very fraudulent way to start your life.
We heard from Jan Waldron and her birth daughter, Rebecca Farrell. Waldron is the author of the new memoir, Giving Away Simone. Simone is Rebecca's former name. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
We have a whole variety of things today, Terry, starting with a big, big bank created by a merger in Japan, a drug testing case before the Supreme Court. Can students be tested for drugs as a condition of participating in athletic programs? This is Kato Kaelin's last day on the witness stand in the OJ trial. We'll review the Kato testimony. Also, we're going to take a look at Hillary Rodham Clinton. She is in India being on a trip which is very much of a traditional first lady's trip, and we'll talk about the role she has now with Elizabeth Drew.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist Jane Smiley is best known for her brooding, tragic novels and stories. But book critic Maureen Corrigan says that in Smiley's latest novel, Moo, Smiley tries to fulfill the comic promise of her last name.
In her last novel, 1,000 Acres, Jane Smiley eerily transposed the plot and characters of King Lear to a windswept farm in central Iowa. Her new novel, entitled Moo, doesn't borrow from the bard, but it does make me think of him, because Moo demonstrates that Smiley, like Shakespeare, has a chameleon imagination. To date, her novels include a few tragedies, a Norse history saga, a murder mystery, and now a comedy. But as Shakespeare's audiences occasionally discovered, experimentation doesn't equal execution. Moo is funny, but in a mild, snickering sort of way. As a comic novel, I'd give Moo 3 laughing cows out of a possible 5. Moo takes place in a sprawling Midwestern state university. Because of its emphasis on agricultural studies, this institution is nicknamed Moo U. The novel opens at the start of fall semester when 24,000 students and their professors invade the campus. By the time Moo ends, you feel like you've met all of them. The narrative here, as it should be in an academic satire, is zany frenetic. Think the Marx Brothers in Duck Soup. In short order, we meet characters like economics professor Dr. Lionel Gift, who calls students customers, and the endearing Dr. Cecilia Sanchez, a transported ethnic urbanite who's baffled by what she feels is the bovine placidity of the Midwest. Sometimes it seemed that everyone she saw, everyone in every room, was determined to be very, very quiet. When she went into stores, the customers seemed to be gliding around on tires. All the smiling made Cecilia uneasy because whatever the distinctions were between types of smiles, they were so fine that she couldn't make them out. The giddy subplots here are almost as multitudinous as the students. Greedy Dr. Gift is covertly consulting for a mining company that plans to strip the last remaining Central American cloud forest. When the leftist chairman of the horticulture department discovers this, righteous pandemonium breaks out. Meanwhile, in an abandoned building in the middle of campus, a mad scientist secretly cultivates the largest hog in the world, a snorting, snuffling beast named Earl Butts, after Nixon's swinish Secretary of Agriculture. The trouble with Moo the novel is that, unlike Moo the university, there isn't anything hefty lurking at the center. Smiley's divine gift as a writer is her ability to plumb the deep and silent reaches of the soul and render them articulate. Her description of what is the age of grief in the novella of that name will stay with me forever. But the hell's a poppin' pace of Moo barely allows Smiley the chance to note a character's name and rank. Maybe I'm being unfair in judging Moo against the standards of Smiley's electrifying tragedies. After all, laughter excuses everything. If Smiley had written the modern equivalent of A Midsummer Night's Dream, or even a hilarious academic spoof like David Lodge's Small World, I wouldn't hold her to any other standard. But instead, Smiley has written a minor key farce. It's awfully hard to get excited over the comedy of errors once you've seen the glories of Hamlet and Lear.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Moo by Jane Smiley. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Audrey Bentham, Chris Fraley, and Richard Parker. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.